For me, it is a pleasure to talk about Piedmont. I started working in the laboratory there in 1959, and one of the first things I learned was that Piedmont was a very special place. It was called a sanatorium then, but later it changed its name to hospital. And it was the atmosphere and the spirit of the place, the spirit of friendliness between staff of all types and nature, that struck me. I loved going down there. I used to spend 3 half-days a week in Piedmont, moving there from the Department of Pathology in UCD in Earlsford Terrace in Dublin. Occasionally, I would be called, even at a weekend, to do a post-mortem, an autopsy, as people like to call it now. The laboratory was small, with a staff of only 3 people and part-time secretarial help. But our job was to look for confirmation of tuberculosis, if that was the favoured diagnosis. But over the many decades that I was there, there was a national, indeed international, change in the incidence of tuberculosis compared to that of cancer of the lung. In other words, cancer of the lung increased and tuberculosis fell. Mind you, the incidence in Ireland of tuberculosis had been falling since 1900. Roughly. This was a natural fall and was nothing to do with new drugs in those days. The drugs infective antibiotics for the treatment of tuberculosis, they only came into use in Ireland in the late 1940s. The days of surgery to treat tuberculosis were now gone. How effective thoracoplasty operations, or the removal of a lung, a tuberculous lung, how effective these radical surgical treatments were is hard to assess. But with the arrival of the antibiotics, they were no longer used, and surgery for tuberculosis died a natural death. The epidemic of cancer was something else. Diagnosis was not easy. One could look down a man's throat or bronchi and see tumours in some, but by no means most, cases. There was another technique which we in Piedmont developed with some success, and that was cytology, meaning examining with the microscope a specimen of sputum and looking for cancer cells. This non-invasive technique suited the patient and was inexpensive. Obviously, there was other laboratory work, routine tests for anemia, biochemical tests of the mundane kind, and also the search for the bacteria causing bronchitis or pneumonia. The background or origin of the staff was something typical of Piedmont, in that many of them were ex-patients. Such people were taken on to work on the farm, in the office administration, and sometimes in the laboratory. Their background in professional training in those days was often non-existent, but their hands-on knowledge was good, and with time, those of them who were younger and newer at the job acquired the necessary qualifications from the Institute of Medical Laboratory Technology. For me, one of the most interesting parts of the work was the performance of post-mortem examinations. It may surprise you that people of 20, young men or young women, would come in a moribund condition and die within a few days from overwhelming tuberculosis. Diagnosed or half-diagnosed before admission, but still fatal tuberculosis. And such cases had to be confirmed. Equally, undiagnosed cancer might be found side by side with tuberculosis in the same patient. And this was clearly a minefield of diagnosis when two serious diseases were at work in the same lung. For somebody like myself working in a teaching environment, the availability of material to show the undergraduates in university college was a bonus. There were and still are less than 5% of such patients who are resistant. But it is the kind of thing that anyone dealing with tuberculosis always has at the back of their mind and always want to be sure about. Clearly, if anti-tuberculosis treatment is to work, the organism that causes the disease has to be sensitive to the drug or medication, as people call it now, to the medication being used. In the great majority of cases, this is true. But if a culture is not made and tested against the various antibiotics, one cannot be certain of the efficacy of the treatment. This means that not just microscopic examination of the sputum to see are there TB present in the sputum, not just that is done, but the full culture and sensitivity must be made. Finding out about the origins of PMount was not anything but good fun for me. I happen to like looking up things. The subsequent writing up of these newly found facts may be more difficult, but I still enjoy it. There is no question at all that Ishbel Lady Aberdeen, who did found the hospital, but that she was a lady of uncommon powers. Some have labelled her one of the first feminists, but for me the word feminist has too many political and sexist connotations. All I would say about her is that she was a great woman.
You said she worked with housewifely precision and Scottish thoroughness to get the hospital started. Is that true?
That is true indeed. I also learned more recently that she acquired these virtues from her mother, who believed in hard work and had a strong faith in the Almighty. That knowledge I gleaned from an article published this year by my old friend Professor Kevin Brannock, or Kevin Walsh as he is also known, who was a physiologist in UCD and is still very much alive. The other point about Ishbel Lady Aberdeen is that her husband had been Governor General, or whatever the correct title is in Canada, under a Liberal government before they both came to Ireland. And indeed this was for the second time, because they'd been here briefly in 1886, I think it was. While in Canada, she had helped to found a nursing organization and had been involved in health education matters as well. As part of her crusade against tuberculosis in Ireland, her idea was that if she educated the mothers in hygienic measures necessary for the control of tuberculosis, it would be one arm, one method of controlling this infectious disease. Another war cry of hers was the encouragement of the drinking of milk, not just milk, but pasteurized milk, and if possible, goat's milk for children. Goat's milk was recommended because goats, unlike cows, did not get tuberculosis. These educational methods were all and were part of her war against tuberculosis and part of the strategy of the Women's National Health Association, which Ishbel Aberdeen had founded in 1907, shortly after she came to Ireland. There is no doubt in my mind that the national idea was there was a correlation between tuberculosis and poverty. There was a social stigma about a family who acquired tuberculosis. And as late as the 1950s in Ireland, when I was a medical student, I can remember my coevals in UCD acquiring some mysterious disease, which meant their absence. But this absence was never talked about. Now I realise, because I confirmed it myself, now I realise that the absence was due to some form of tuberculosis. To equate poverty with tuberculosis may be explained by the fact that it is commoner among the poor or the less well off. But that you can blame the family for being poor is a very false argument. The cause of tuberculosis was discovered and described by Koch, K-O-C-H, Koch, in 1882. But the medical profession did not entirely believe the great Robert Koch, and especially that tuberculosis was carried in the air, spread by aerial methods. This acceptance of a confirmed fact with a known organism responsible for tuberculosis, it took many years for this belief to become active in the sense of controlling the spread of it. Prophets are not listened to. The other point is that there was a strong belief, not just in Ireland, that tuberculosis was hereditary, handed down from father or mother to children as a hereditary disease. And the only truth in that statement is that because one parent was infected, they infected their children. It was not a hereditary disease. As regards treatment in Piemont, for many years it was simple and bore had no antibiotic backup. Each patient was trained in the care and disposal of the sputum they coughed up. Each patient had one mug, one knife, one fork, and one spoon, which the patient themselves kept and cleaned for their own use. It meant the sterilization of bed linen after death or after discharge. The atmosphere of fresh air and sleeping or resting outside rather than living closely together in a windowless or window closed room was another advantage of the sanatorium. I've indirectly suggested that treatment was confined to rest, and more rest, but with some recovery, gradually moving on to an occupational activity if they had improved enough to allow it, such activity was also important. For men, there was carpentry, boot repairing, gardening, work on the farm. For the women, there were the obvious domestic activities of knitting and sewing and housekeeping. But above all, for the children, and unlike nowadays, about 20% of the patients resident in Piedmont were children. For these children, there was education. And this was carried on by one lady who continued for many years, with the help of only one assistant. She continued in charge of the primary schools. Holidays for her, or indeed for the children, were not long. They were short. But she managed this work for so many years, to me an astounding and extraordinary achievement, something I can't imagine happening these days.
Now, there were changes in the hospital, Dr. Healy, in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Could you tell me something about those changes?
Of course. I mentioned the increase of cancer and the fall in tuberculosis. The other disease that was increasing was chronic bronchitis and emphysema, largely, as we all know now, due to cigarette smoking. These patients had been coughing for many years, perhaps short of breath, and they were also liable to suffer acute bouts of bronchitis or even pneumonia, which clearly required hospital treatment. They were recurring cases, meaning that they could be discharged and came back, but they were an important group and still are in Piedmont to this day. If they had bronchitis, chronic or acute, and emphysema, with time, some of these patients, their lungs were permanently damaged, and also, as a complication, the heart might be affected. We have all heard of high blood pressure, which usually means that the left side of the heart is enlarged. But if the lung is damaged for a long while, the right side of the heart can enlarge, and that enlarged heart can go on to heart failure, which eventually may be fatal. Such cases increased in number, along with the similar rise in cancer of the lung that we've mentioned already. And these chronic but not always sick patients needed new pulmonary function tests and perhaps different antibiotics to continue to live with some difficulty.
Okay, now you said, apart from the lung treatment, that Piemont was able to change to accommodate elderly people and people with, in the ID unit, people who had intellectual disabilities?
Yes. That group began to arrive when I was not long in Piemont. To me, the striking thing about them, and this isn't just, this is now well known, such patients, for example, those with Down syndrome, in the pre-antibiotic era, they used to die about the age of 25 or 30, or even younger, die from ordinary infections. But now, with modern medicine, they lived longer. As an example of this, one encouraging thing in my final years in Piemont was that Liam Power, who was the man in charge of the intellectually handicapped unit, if any one of his charges died, suddenly or not, he insisted that there should be an autopsy. And this was something that I admired and was happy to cooperate with him about.
Okay, and those people found they were able to do useful jobs and workshops.
Indeed. The first job that they did was dismantling ESB meters, the metal things that people have in their homes. And this was partly due to John O'Donoghue, who worked for the ESB and also, of course, worked voluntarily for Piemont Hospital and became chairman of the board. The other workshop activity was the making of chip baskets and containers, and that continued for some time also. For what modern occupational work they're engaged in, I refer you to the present annual report.
Okay.
Because I'm ignorant.
Okay, so Piemont was able to adapt to changing circumstances and take in different people. So do you see it being able to continue and have a bright future?
There is bound to be a future for Piemont. The only problem I see about it is, will there be enough beds? There will be no shortage of patients, whatever type of patient you talk about. And I think the people who now live or spend their last days there are lucky, very lucky, to be in the middle of a place surrounded by green fields with a view of the Dublin and Wicklow mountains when they get bored with TV or reading the papers. The grounds are very well kept, with good walkways for the ambulant or indeed for wheelchairs. To sum up what has been a short and personal account, what have I to say about Piemont? The atmosphere is unique, and it is welcoming. I myself have often imagined spending my terminal days here myself.